Good morning from 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. Now, welcome to our election special candidates forum. As each Saturday this month, we speak to one candidate running for local or state office. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Now, here are your hosts, Bob McAdams and Jeff Leonard.
Good Saturday morning, Charlottesville. I am Jeff Leonard, founder and general manager of 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
And I'm Bob McAdams, special events coordinator at WPVC.
Today we're co-hosting a WPVC election special, one of our interviews with Democratic candidates to represent the 17th district in the state Senate. WPVC does not endorse any candidate for public office, but we provide this information to you, our listeners, to help choose the best candidate.
With us in the studio this morning is State Senate candidate Ben Hickson. Ben, welcome to WPVC.
Thank you for having me.
Ben, let's start by learning a little bit about you. We do this with each one of the candidates we interview. Where were you born and what was your life like as you were growing up?
So I was born in Louisiana. I'm from a big family of public school teachers, actually. My granddad was a high school principal down in Mangum, Louisiana. My nana was a second grade reading teacher. My aunt Helene is a social studies teacher. So I was born in Monroe, Louisiana, which is in the north part of Louisiana. And then my mom decided to get her PhD, so we moved down to Lafayette, which is the heart of Cajun country, I guess. And so she went to get her PhD in English. And now she is a English professor at Middle Tennessee State University. She's actually one of our leading authorities on children's literature. So she, for years, she ran the regional Southern Children's Literature Conference. She was the president of the Children's Literature Association. I love writing about my mom. The president of the Children's Literature Association, that's the International Society for Children's Literature. You know, growing up, you know, I was on the math team. I was captain of my math team for years in high school. I came out of the closet when I was in between 10th grade and 11th grade. And, you know, that was pretty good. That was, you know, it's different for all of us when we come out. But, you know, I had supportive parents. I remember it's a little different now than it was in the 90s. Parents were still, I think, learning about it maybe more then. It was becoming more and more socially accessible. But my dad took me on this drive around the block and then basically said, I don't care if you screw pumpkins, you're still my son. Yeah, and then I went to, and then we're going to get to the education a little bit. But yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that education.
Okay.
What has your education and your work background given you to help prepare you to serve as a member of the state Senate?
Yeah, so I went to undergrad in New York City for computer science. I went to grad school in Seattle for computer science. In between, I worked at a research lab. I was a research programmer at the Columbia University Center for Computational Learning Systems in Seattle. I worked at a research lab there. I was a National Science Foundation research fellow. I worked at a startup in artificial intelligence and natural language processing. That's my field, building computer systems that try to figure out human language. So it's a little different from politics, but it does give me a solid foundation in problem solving and being pragmatic and objective. And I like to, I'm a big believer in finding well-defined solutions to problems. So defining the problem well and then finding concrete solutions on how to fix it.
It also gives you a look into the future. I mean, I don't know what's coming down the pipe for AI, but apparently you do. So maybe you can enlighten us a little bit later.
Now, Ben, you're seeking the nomination for senator from the 17th State Senate District.
Right.
And what area does the 17th District cover?
Right. So it doesn't include any of the city itself of Charlottesville, but in the northeast corner of Albemarle County all the way over to Fredericksburg. So you've got the tiny northeast corner of Albemarle, the most of Louisa, a good about half of Culpeper, all of Orange, all of Fredericksburg City, and kind of maybe a middle third of Spotsy.
And who holds the seat now? I think this person is my state senator.
Is he? Okay.
I think so.
Well, so it's Bryce Reeves is our current senator.
Bryce was tussling with some people here recently, I think, wasn't he? We probably want to comment on that. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC 17th District State Senate Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. And with us in studio today is Ben Hickson. Ben, how have you been active in recent years to help improve life in Central Virginia?
Yeah. So in 2017, I ran for the House of Delegates against Nick Freitas. You know, politics was not something that was on my mind, but after Donald Trump got elected president, like many people, my priorities completely changed. I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to fight back. And so I started reading more about local politics and I read more about our local delegate, Nick Freitas. and I did not like what I found. I did not like what I read. And so he was actually ran unopposed in 2015. So I decided to run against him. And so I did. And actually, I ended up doing incredibly well. I was one of the best performing Democrats in that seat in 20 years. So Nick Freitas represents House District 30. That's kind of the middle chunk of the Senate district I'm running for now, like the middle conservative part. It's Culpeper in Orange County. And so I did extremely well then. I was the best performing Democrat in that seat in 20 years. And a lot of it was just part of that excitement, that energy, that infrastructure. And being at the forefront of fighting back and making a difference carried me over to 2018. And so I decided to run for chair of the Democratic Party of Culpeper County. And so that's what I've been doing for the last year, organizing Culpeper. Now, we instituted a lot of reforms in our party. For example, getting a Culpeper Young Democrats group going first time in many years. And we did real electioneering campaigns, postcard campaigns for voter awareness. We sent handwritten postcards to everybody in Culpeper who voted for president but didn't vote for governor, explaining, hey, you need to vote this year. We have an election every year in Virginia, and you need to vote this year for Abigail Spanberger, and here's how to do it. And we explained where the voter registration office is and how to vote early. And we had events all over the county, fundraising events. We had people at every polling place. We organized the hell out of Culpeper. And it paid off because we had hundreds of volunteers in and out of our office every day up to Election Day. And on Election Day itself, Abigail Spanberger won every single precinct in the town of Culpeper. And I don't know how well y'all know Culpeper, but it is a pretty conservative area.
It's not the bastion of liberalism that is Charlottesville.
Well, it is now. You know, we flipped every precinct in Culpeper for Abigail, and now we're an island of blue. We nobody thought this was possible. She dramatically overperformed expectations in Culpeper. She won every precinct. I'm just so proud of her, and I'm proud of that effort and that difference that I've made in my community.
Yeah, she was an excellent mm-hmm. candidate.
Absolutely.
Didn't Nick Freitas wind up running for governor in the Republican primary?
Yeah, he did. So when I was running against him in 2017, he was simultaneously campaigning for delegate and getting ready to run for the United States Senate. And so he had a primary against Corey Stewart.
Noted Confederate flag wearer.
Yeah,
Corey
him.
Stewart. And,
that's him.
You know, I think we invited him to come here one time. He wouldn't even return your calls,
okay.
Right, Bob?
Probably.
You know, running for a seat in the Senate is a huge deal. It takes a ton of sacrifice on both personal levels and professional levels. Why did you decide to run now, and why did you choose the Senate?
Yeah, so I decided to serve after Donald Trump got elected. You know, our politics was broken, and I wanted to fix it. That was kind of what I my approach going in. I wanted to make a difference. I saw something that I did not think was working. My engineering instincts kicked in, I guess, and I decided to fix it. And so I've been now involved in politics since then. Why I decided to run for this seat in particular is because of Bryce Reeves. Bryce Reeves is one of the most extreme, most homophobic senators in Virginia. When I was campaigning for delegate in 2017, Bryce was running for lieutenant governor. He was running in the primary against Jill Vogel, and he was campaigning on the idea that I, as an openly gay person, should not be allowed to serve the public as a judge. I should not be allowed to serve the public. He actually sent campaign mail out saying this. This is my own senator. I was running to be his colleague in the General Assembly, and he's out campaigning on the idea that I shouldn't have the same opportunities in life that he has. This is the kind of person who represents me. I actually wrote to my paper. I had, talk saying, hey, do you think this about judges? Do you think I'm not qualified to be your colleague? You know, if he never responded to me, of course, but if he thinks that I'm not allowed to be his colleague, I'm not allowed to serve the public alongside him, then I'm just going
to
replace
him. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC 17th District State Senate Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams, and with us in the studio today is Ben Hixon. Ben, the Unite the Right rally on August 11th and 12th of 2017, it traumatized the communities in and around Charlottesville. Now, during the lead-up to that rally, especially during the month after the July 8th KKK rally in Charlottesville, the city council struggled to deal with a permit request for the Unite the Right rally. Now, if some group requested a permit for a potentially violent event, any municipality in Virginia could face a similar dilemma of having to choose between free speech and public safety. What should the state government do to support municipalities caught in that dilemma?
Yeah, this is a great question. I was actually running for delegate when this happened, and it traumatized us. You know, I was one of the Charlottesville area delegates. It was depressing. It was it was a knife in the gut, really. And my first door, the first door that I knocked on after August 12th was it was an African American woman. Her name was Acadia, and she told me that she almost did not open the door for me because I was a white guy that she didn't know. So that's the kind of that was the effect. That kind of fear and divisiveness and hate that it engendered on us. That's what we're struggling with. That was what they were going for. I think that was what the terrorist attacks were going for. They wanted to divide us and make us afraid of each other. And we can't let that happen. So what we're the dilemma that we're facing here is how do we respond to that kind of hate, that kind of evil. But while at the same time protecting our constitutional right to assemble. And that's also something that we absolutely need to protect. I'll give you a good example. I was knocking on the door the other day of her in Fredericksburg, and her talked to somebody whose name was Sahim, and she was a math professor, Germana, and she's from Pakistan. And she was afraid of this recent spate of laws of requiring government contractors to swear loyalty oaths to Israel, right, and preventing any kind of peaceful assembly or peaceful protest against Israel. And so that's kind of the other argument. How can we maintain? And she was afraid of that, and so she wanted me to make sure that I would tell her that I would fight against any similar laws in Virginia. And I said, yes, I would. And so those are the two kind of sides that we're dealing with here. At a state level, we need to make sure that local governments have the resources they need to protect their communities, to allow peaceful assemblies without nobody. We have the right to peacefully assemble. We do not have the right to break the law. We do not have the right to violence. And so we need to make sure that local law enforcement has the resources to allow peaceful assemblies while prosecuting anybody who does break the law and who does commit acts of violence, prosecuting them to the full extent of the law.
Now, those events in Charlottesville on August 11th and 12th, they showed the overt racism of white supremacists, and you've mentioned a couple of examples. Mm-hmm. On a broader view, the Southern Poverty Law Center reports a rapid increase in the number of hate groups over the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. How should the General Assembly respond to the overt racism of white supremacy?
Yeah. By being equally as steadfast, equally as forceful in our efforts to combat systemic racism in all aspects of our society, from criminal justice to education.
Okay. Now, those events of July and August of 2017, they also uncovered covert racism that's been embedded in our institutions over many years. Now, it's been more than a year and a half has gone by since those August events. Where do you think we are now in race relations in Central Virginia, and where are we headed? And where do you think we are now in race relations in Virginia as a whole, and where are we headed?
Yeah, so there's still a lot of work to do. But we also have to look at this as an opportunity, as something that President Obama, he opened the dialogue. He was great at this. He exposed it. It's not that he created racism, as he exposed that the racism had already been there, and he's given us an opportunity to talk about it. Same with these events in Charlottesville. We need to take this as an opportunity to talk about the systemic racism in our system, to talk and to maybe get serious on criminal justice reform, serious on academic equality. So there's still a lot of work to do, but I think there's a clear road for progress ahead.
You know, Charlottesville, in my estimation, is well ahead of the curve in sort of taking on these institutions that have previously and systemically favored mm-hmm. whites over blacks. Mm-hmm. And you're from Culpeper, on your Facebook videos, you spend a lot of time in Fredericksburg knocking mm-hmm. on doors. Mm-hmm. Where are the other, our neighboring communities in their acknowledgement and hopeful future transition to sort of a destruction of these institutions of white supremacy? Are they far behind us, or are they just beginning or are they less far behind us in your estimation?
Well, I think that there's I don't know if there's not like a metric you can put a number to put it. I mean, I think that we all are aware of how much we need to be fighting racism. I have conversations about this every day. So I don't think you can say, well, here's one community that doesn't have as full of an understanding as another. And well, it really what it takes is people like me knocking on doors every day, and really just us as neighbors talking to each other and being able to talk about this out in the open. And that's kind of what I was alluding to previously when I said that, you know, this is a chance to bring these issues out in the open, to be able to talk about them up front, instead of so that it's no longer just, you know, buried under the table.
Yeah, one of the funny things, Charlottesville, one of the things I love about Charlottesville is we invited Normal here, and we had our chief of police, our chief prosecutor, mm-hmm. and a couple of our city councilors up there mm-hmm. talking about the support for legalization of marijuana. And mm-hmm. I don't know if Culpeper or Fredericksburg are that are there quite yet. But
Culpeper has a great Culpeper Normal group. You know, I fully support legalization as well, and so I've been there a couple of times. And actually, Pam Novy, who was the previous chair of Virginia Normal, before Jim Michelle is now the current chair, but she was the previous chair of Virginia Normal, and she became chair of the Culpeper Normal. She's actually the treasurer of she was my treasurer when I was chair of the CCDC. So we have there's a very strong, it's something I campaigned on in 2017 as well. I think legalization has a very strong bipartisan appeal.
I do too. I think we've hit the tipping point with that. Yeah. So this is a question that is probably hits very closely to home for you. And the prejudice comes in many forms. You know, women still earn less than men for doing the same work, and members of the LGBTQ community can be fired without cause simply for being who they are. What should our state government do to overcome these injustices?
Yeah, so this is something, like you said, is close to home. It's something that affects real people, real Virginians. If you travel to a job, for example, if you spend a lot of money moving to a new job, and then your sexuality never comes up in a job interview, of course, and then your new employer, when you get there, he sees a picture of your husband or something on your desk, and he says, "Oh, I didn't know you're gay. You're fired." I mean, think about the financial damage. Think about the actual personal damage that causes. So it's something that, you know, we have to plan our lives around. It's not just a little thing in the back of our mind. It's something that we have to face on a daily basis. We have to plan our lives around. So there are things that we can do. So Bryce Reeves, for example, has voted against protecting LGBT employment discrimination. He's voted against making it illegal for landlords to discriminate against gay tenants. I was being harassed by my landlord last year. You know, I don't know for sure that it was about whether or not, you know, I was gay, but it's just wrapped up in everything else. It's wrapped up in policy, and it's just something we have to deal with on a daily basis. So I do think we need to, you know, ban discrimination for LGBT, make it illegal for landlords to discriminate against LGBT tenants. In general, we need to pass the ERA. This is something that's obvious, right? It's a no-brainer. We need to, you know, say that, you know, everybody has equality under the law, regardless of sex. So those are just a few of the things we can do at the state level.
I struggle to understand Mr. Reeves and others' positions mm-hmm. on those topics. I really can't wrap my brain around them. Maybe I should. I don't know. The white supremacists mm-hmm. in Charlottesville in August 2017 The white supremacists in Charlottesville in August 2017 came armed with handguns and assault rifles. Only one handgun was fired on August 12th, but gun violence takes the lives of many Virginians every day. How do you assess the problem of gun violence, and what laws do you believe the General Assembly should enact in response?
Yeah, so I'm a big FDR fan, and he said one of his four freedoms was that we're not free from fear. And so our kids shouldn't be afraid to go to school. And that's why I do support, you know, common sense measures like background checks on all public sales of weapons, on support gun violence restraining orders. So these are also called red flag laws. This is where if a friend or family member or doctor has clear and convincing evidence that you're a danger to yourself and others, he can escalate it. He can take it to a police officer who says, "Holy cow." He takes it to a judge that just says, "Holy cow, let's do something about it." And so those are things that we can do to make sure that, you know, dangerous people don't have weapons, while not demonizing gun owners at the same time. And I think there's also an underlying issue here, which is, and it's something that doesn't get talked often enough about, which is that 2/3 of gun deaths are suicide. Right, 30% of the LGBT community attempts suicide.
30%?
30%, yeah.
Holy cow.
The CDC, according to the CDC, 30%.
That's shocking.
It's multiple orders, as compared to about 6% of non-LGBT. So it's a huge problem in my community and just in general. And, I mean, I think we need to dramatically expand access to mental health care.
Well, we'll talk about that in a bit, I would imagine, if I know Bob McAdams like I do. Mm. Hey, this is a great conversation. We need to take a short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard. I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams, my friend Bob McAdams, a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with 17th District State Senate candidate Ben Hixon. Bob and Ben, we're talking about the issues.
And we keep on coming up with good, strong issues here. Having health care is another issue, and people have to have it available in a time of need. It's just a necessity for everybody in our area. Now, lowering the high cost of health insurance is another need for many people in the 17th District. What efforts by state government should be taken to address these real concerns, and what further actions are needed?
Yeah, so it's a human right. We're not, if our family is sick and we're working multiple jobs and we can't afford the doctor's fee, that's not free. Right. So in Louisa, not only do they not have a hospital, they don't even have a 24-hour medical center. So this is a serious problem that we need to be working on. And I was proud to be at the forefront of the fight for Medicaid expansion in 2017. Right. It's something that I campaigned on a lot. And it's the reason that we have it now is thanks to candidates like me, like Kellen Squire, people running in conservative areas. And talking every day about our need for Medicaid expansion. And we changed enough minds. We talked to enough moderates and Republicans that we impressed upon our Republican legislature, unfortunately still Republican-controlled legislature, we impressed upon enough of them that we do need this now, that a few changed their minds. And so that's why we have Medicaid expansion. I was proud of that, but we do need to go further. I think it needs to include dental care. For example, Medicaid provides only minimal dental, and so we need to go further. We need to make sure that this is such an important and integral part of our overall health. Same for vision as well. So we need to make Medicaid more robust, and of course, we need to protect it because there will be continued attempts by the Republicans who keep calling it socialism, as if that's some wild accusation and so we need to protect. We need to protect the Medicaid expansion. Because of the complexity of health insurance, a lot of it is dealt with at the federal level. But there's more that we can do at the state level, not just Medicaid expansion, things like telemedicine. And I'm really happy that the nurse practitioners are now able to practice independently. So we need to, that just was signed into law, something I actually campaigned on in 2017. As well, so we need to protect that.
Now, access to health care is a challenge for many Virginians, but getting care for mental illness is even more of a challenge. There are limits to insurance coverage, and there's a lack of professionals in the field, and that means that many people with mental health problems just go untreated. What should the state do to help people with mental illness?
Yeah, it's huge. It's so important to me. As I alluded to earlier, my own community has, the suicide rate is astronomical. That's a particular personal importance to me. And I absolutely agree with Senator Deeds when he says that our mental health care system is chaotic. That's the word that he used. So I think we need to dramatically expand access to mental health care. We need to make it so normalized that going for a mental health checkup is just as common as going for any other, going to the dentist or for any other health treatment. We need to quadruple the number of psychologists in our schools, of counselors in our schools, so that they can be teaching things like self-harm prevention and anger management, right? And I think we need to work on and improve. We need to better fund our CSBs, our community service boards, and also work on communication between them as well. And we also need to work on increasing just the workforce, especially in rural areas and access in rural areas. And one thing we can do is talk about telemedicine. But, of course, that takes us back to rural broadband. So in order, we do need to have reliable, affordable internet in the rural areas, because those are some of the communities with the least access to providers, and so that's where telemedicine is needed the most. And ironically, that's where telemedicine is needed the most is also where internet is available the least.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 17th District State Senate Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard, and with us in studio today is Ben Hixon. Ben, we're talking about mental illness. And I want to talk about how it leads to our criminal justice system. The superintendent at Argent Local Jail, which I think is one of the most progressive jails in the area, has said that about 50% of the people in jail suffer from some form of mental illness, and 80% of them have substance abuse problems. Other jails and prisons in Virginia likely have the same problems. What changes in our criminal justice system are needed, And what should the General Assembly do to address this reality?
This is it's huge. This is something that's personally very, very important to me. It's going to be one of my central focuses as senator. We over-criminalize, we over-punish, and we enforce our laws unfairly. And so I support a host of quite strong reforms to our criminal justice system. And marijuana legalization is just one among many. I think we need to end cash bail. You know, the ACLU says that 46% of people in jail right now are there just because they can't afford to pay, you know, the bail fee. I think we need to get rid of cash bail. We need to put institute risk-based, pretrial release for. We need to raise the larceny limit. You know, we raise it from 200 to 500, which is a start, but still, you know, I think we need to up it to 2,000 so that you don't lose your ability to get a job, and you don't, you know, your right life isn't ruined for stealing a jacket. We need to raise the public defender limit so that we can even the playing field between those with money and those without. There's a few of the reforms that we can put in place. So that we're not unfairly enforcing the laws.
Statistics reveal another issue with the criminal justice system, that is systemic racism, from police stops to prosecutions to incarcerations. Whites have a clear advantage over people of color, pardon me. What should the General Assembly do to make sure all Virginians can trust that justice is equally administered by police officers, prosecuting attorneys, judges, probation officers, and prison staff?
Yeah, I'll give you a great example. There's no racial disparity in marijuana use in Virginia, and yet you're three times more likely to be arrested for possession if you're black than if you're white. And this is it's ridiculous and it's unfair. And this is where, you know, we need to continue to be self-aware and to continue to have this conversation. And we need to. It takes constant vigilance, and it takes training. It takes resources. We need to make sure our officers are well trained and are aware of the racism itself in our system, and it's going to take an incredible amount of work, and it's going to take a legislature that is aware of the problems we need to face.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC 17th District State Senate Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams. Ben, the New York Times ProPublica report on the achievement gap between the races in Charlottesville and Albemarle schools, well, it alarmed educators, students, parents, residents alike. Now, both school boards and everyone in the school division have tried to address this problem. The same problem exists in other school divisions throughout the 17th district. What role does the state government have in this problem, and what should the General Assembly do to address this achievement gap?
Yeah, terrific question. This is a lot of this comes back to that racial inequality that we see in all aspects of society. And it comes back to the overcriminalization in schools, and it's inherently tied together with the school to prison pipeline. So this is where we teach our kids to become criminals. We overcriminalize and overpunish in the schools, and so when kids are acting up, we jail them essentially, and they learn to be criminals. And it's inherently racist. So there's I'll give you a couple of good examples. Disorderly conduct. So this is a misdemeanor that's punishable by a year in prison. And 40% of all disorderly conduct charges filed against minors are actually for behavior that takes place in school or on a school bus. All right, so what's happening is our kids are acting up in school and being sent to jail for it. It is absolutely ridiculous. Now, here is the key stat that two-thirds of all these disorderly conduct misdemeanor charges are against black kids. 23%, about something like 23% of our youth in school is black, but two-thirds of disorderly conduct charges are filed against black kids. This is an inherently racist system. A lot of it is we don't have enough African-American authority figures in schools. This is where diversity comes in. We need to be constantly diversifying. But I do agree with Mike Mullen and Jennifer McClellan. What they try to do is make it no longer possible to file a disorderly conduct misdemeanor charge against a kid for behavior that takes place in school or on a school bus. This is a bill they try to get passed. I completely agree. It's simple, practical, pragmatic, and easy to implement solutions like this that I'm personally fond of, and I think that's what we need to do step by step to eliminate the school to prison pipeline, and that's which will tackle head on the racial inequity in our schools.
Now, recently released housing needs assessment for Planning District 10 for Central Virginia shows that many people in the area struggle to afford a place to live. Many groups in the area are calling for more affordable housing, and that brings up related concerns about racial disparities in home ownership, gentrification in urban areas that forces people out of their homes, and substandard rural homes. What role does the state have in efforts to increase the availability of affordable housing?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of FDR. I think I said this already. In his 11th State of the Union, he says that true individual liberty requires economic liberty, and he gives this list of rights, and one of them is the right to shelter. We're not free. We don't have real personal liberty without a roof over our head. And so affordable housing is one of, it's something that I actually hear about all the time. It's one of the top issues in my own district. We can do things like fully fund the public housing trust. So Ralph Northam asked for $19 million for the public housing trust. He only got $4 million. We can do better than that. We can create zones of opportunity to incentivize to incentivize development. We can, there's a zoning issues. This is more of a local, this isn't a state, but there's zoning issues here in Charlottesville. The zoning for new housing development has some serious reform. And we can remember that this is not just about having houses and about development. This is fundamental to economic inequality.
You know, higher pay would make housing and everything else more affordable. Virginia has a minimum hourly wage of $7.25. A bill to increase the minimum wage in stages to $15 an hour failed in the Senate this year. The most recent Orange Dot report showed higher pay would make housing and everything else more affordable. Virginia has an hourly minimum wage of $7.25. A bill to increase the minimum wage in stages to $15 an hour failed in the Senate this year. The most recent Orange Dot report showed that the great number of people in Central Virginia, in areas including Louisa and Albemarle, who cannot afford to pay for the basic necessities, including housing. What should the state do to address income inequalities and bring wages up to a livable level?
Yeah, so we need a living wage. I support raising the minimum wage at a state level. I especially support letting localities have control over their own minimum wage, because what works in Culpeper is not necessarily the same as what works in Charlottesville.
You know, when people live far away from urban areas in order to find affordable housing, they incur the transportation costs of commutes. What changes do you support to make public transportation a viable alternative to single-occupant car travel for both commuting and inner-urban travel?
Yeah, so this is a huge problem. It's not just about, it's environmental. It's a quality of life. It's about how about access to affordable housing. If we have more public transport, more public transportation, or just better transportation infrastructure, then there's a greater range of affordable housing areas that we can develop. So there's a lot of things we can do. For example, the stretch of I-95 between Fredericksburg and D.C. So this is, Fredericksburg is in my district, and it was recently rated the worst in the country.
You're talking about that big six-lane parking lot they have up there?
Yeah, exactly. And we have to sit, you sit in your car for hours, and when you're doing that, you're not with your family, right? You're not working. You're just sitting there listening to music. And it's a quality of life issue. So we can do short term, we need to be funding VDOT's, short term, we need to be working on our roads, improving our roads, widening roads. This is important. A little bit longer term, we need to be funding VDOT's Department of Innovation. They're working on some great things like digital traffic lights and smart cars, where the cars talk to the traffic lights, talk to each other, so that we can be smarter about how we use the roads. Longer term, we need to make sure we have that public transportation is regular. Make sure things like the VREs is on a regular basis, so that it's reliable. Because if your bus or your train is 20 minutes late, then you're 20 minutes late. And then much longer term, I think we should be looking at things like light rail. That's farther in the future.
Yeah, one of the best things Charlottesville ever did was reopen or revitalize the train station. Mm-hmm. And let the Amtrak come through here two or three times a day. That's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. For us. Thank you, Ben. But we need to interrupt this discussion for another short break. We'll be right back. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard, and I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with 17th District State Senate candidate Ben Hixon. Bob and Ben, we've got one more segment to talk about the issues.
Now, Ben, recent reports from scientists tell us that the climate change crisis is much worse than previously understood. with years, not decades, to act. Now, young people who understand the urgency of this crisis, they're condemning the lack of action by older people who are the ones in positions of power. Now, this crisis overlays all the other problems we have discussed. What should the state government do to accelerate reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and hasten the transition to renewable energy sources?
Yeah, this is one of our most major public health crises of our time. It's one of the greatest threats to our way of life that we know. And our coastline is flooding now. This is not a far future problem. This is a now problem. It's an immediate problem. Glenn Bessa actually had a good roadmap in Blue Virginia the other day about some of the things that we can do. And I support a lot of what he said, things like we have a great coastline for wind. Let's take advantage of wind power. Solar freedom. We need to be working on more clean energy. I think especially we need to be getting Dominion out of our politics. This is why when I ran in 2017, I pledged not to take any money from Dominion. And when I decided to declare again this year, one of the very first things I did was to sign the pledge not to take any money from Dominion or any corporate PAC, because these fossil fuel lobbyists own too many of our politicians. And I should not be I should not be owned by public utilities, the companies that I need to regulate. So get Dominion out of our politics. And again, solar freedom and clean energy.
Now, every candidate has aspirations for problem solving, and all those aspirations will eventually meet the limits of the state budget. How do you think the General Assembly should reconcile the needs for real change with the level of revenue coming from current taxes? What new sources of revenue could the state use to meet the needs of the people?
So there's several things we can do to generate revenue. A big one I keep returning to this is marijuana legalization, because Colorado capped $1 billion in tax revenue from this industry. How about let's legalize and regulate here and tax so we can build a few more roads and pay our teachers a little bit more and fund that public housing trust that we were talking about. We have essentially a flat tax in Virginia. The highest the highest tax bracket is $18,000. So people who make $18,000 and up pay the same tax rate as people who make $180,000 or $180 million a year. So I would support another tax bracket to make our income tax a little more progressive, because I think the fairest tax is the one that's most affordable. And so when you can afford, when you can't afford to pay as much, you shouldn't have to. And so when we have tax, actually here in Virginia, if you make less than $22,000, you pay a higher tax rate, 10% in state and local taxes, than people who make over $500,000 a year. So it's actually including all state and local taxes. We have regressive taxation. That's absolutely not fair. So, more progressive income tax. And also there's plenty of ways we can cut, especially in criminal justice reform. It costs $85 a day to keep somebody in jail, but only $3 a day to have out to have pretrial services. So this goes back to getting rid of cash bail that I was talking about earlier. If we have less pretrial or no pretrial detention except for high risk cases, then that's actually going to be much less cost to us as well.
For local governments to meet the need of their residents, they must have authorization from the General Assembly, either through general laws applicable to all or through special acts for individual local governments. What do you think the relationship between the General Assembly and local governments should be?
Yes, I think this ties into the Dillon Rule. So this is where localities are not allowed to do anything without state permission. I think we need to get rid of it. I'd like to see us go back to a home rule state. I think government should act like a pyramid. Federal government at the top with the least control of our lives. In Culpeper, we have this Sheriff Jenkins, who thinks he's another Corey Stewart. And so he has used the two. We're only one of two counties in Virginia that has the 287G program. This is where we're now a deputy of ICE. And so he's enforcing federal immigration laws with the county resources. Now, let the federal government do their thing and enforce their laws. Then let state governments. And then at the bottom, local government. The best government is the one that's the closest to the people. We need to have local government having the most, they know their own communities best. They should be the ones making the most law. So let's get rid of the Dillon Rule and give localities the flexibility to make their own laws.
Can people hear about the Dillon Rule, but can you explain what that Dillon Rule is and how it works?
Right. So I think I touched on that a little bit. This is where a locality is not allowed to do something without express permission from the state government. So we think about, you know, we have the at the federal government, there's a enumerated power, so there's a limited number of things that they're allowed to do, but then the state kind of can do the rest. But here in the analogy at the state level, you would think that, okay, well, the state has a limited number of things they can do, and then localities can do the rest. That's not how it works here. Here, a locality can only do something with the express permission of the state government first. So the statue, the monuments, is a great example. Here, we're not allowed to touch the monuments without permission from the state. And, I mean, that's ridiculous. Of course, localities should be empowered to, you know, decide what statues are on their own public property.
People also often feel frustrated with the lack of action by the General Assembly. The governmental system in Virginia seems designed to prevent change. The General Assembly is in session for only 60 days on even-numbered years and 45 days on the odd. In that brief time, legislators will consider a few thousand bills, most of which are killed in subcommittee. How will you get things done in the General Assembly if you're elected?
Yeah, great question. A lot of it is going to be, I'm going to be looking for mentors. You know, I'm going to be talking to senators I respect, like Senator Creed Deeds. I'm even going to be looking across the aisle and talking to senators I respect on the Republican side, like Senator Emmett Hanger. I'm going to be looking for mentorship. It's going to take work and preparedness throughout the year, and that's why I'm pledging to have monthly town halls, even in the off, you know, even when we're not in session. So this is so I'm going to meet in the various, have a town hall every month, and have, I'm probably going to run them a lot, like I ran the county party meetings as chair. Won't use Robert's rules, but we will have you know, open public comment periods, and so that'll give me a chance to have dialogues with the people I'm representing, because, you know, it's, I don't know everything, and I'm going to be looking for experts, and I'm going to be having conversations with the people I represent, so that we can work together as a partnership and solve problems together and listen to each other and treat each other like neighbors and have good common ground solutions, instead of just me being at the beck and call of either not knowing what I'm doing at all or being at the beck and call of special interest.
Now, you'll still be facing the high number of bills in a short amount of period. How can that become more efficient? I know a lot of the bills that people have proposed for conservation, for environmental problems, for gun control, have been killed in subcommittee.
Yeah, ERA is, of course, a great example. This was something that 80% of Virginians wanted, and Mark Culp's killed it in his subcommittee. And the turnaround time was very short. We had very limited amount of time to organize and to respond. I think if you're asking, do I support making the legislative session longer? I don't know. I'd have to look into that. But you know, it's something I would have to look into.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 17th District State Senate Forum interview with Ben Hixon. I'm Bob McAdams. Ben, in the June 11th primary, you're running for the Democratic nomination for senator from the 17th District. This district extends over a wide area from Fredericksburg to Albemarle. How will you engage voters in this June election? And then generally, how can voter participation be increased in all elections?
So for the primary, what I've been focusing almost all my time on is personal door knocking. This was my strategy back in 2017. It's why I did so well. It's why I was one of the handful of Democratic delegates in Virginia to match Ralph Northam's performance. Most candidates ran about 5 points behind him, and I matched him exactly. I even overperformed Ralph Northam in a few of the precincts in my district, and I attribute that almost entirely to my personal conversations at the door. I spent every single day. Here's what my days look like. 9 to 4, knocking on doors. Then I'll take an hour break, and then the rest, and then 5 to 8, calling donors, asking for money. That's the life of a candidate. And so, I really emphasize that door knocking, that personal door knocking. I knocked over 5,000 doors last time I ran. I'm actually on track to knock even more this year. I've knocked on over 1,000 doors already. So personal interaction at the door is how I'm personally engaging voters. We're going to have some other robust things like texting and phone banking and postcard campaigns. I'm a big fan of that. We did a lot of that when I was party chair, you know, the voter awareness and voter education campaigns I was talking about earlier. In general, how do we increase voter awareness? There's so many electoral and voting reforms that we need to be working on. Same-day voter registration, no excuse to absentee balloting. How about automatic restoration of rights? That's ridiculous. We need anybody after they serve their time should be able to vote without having to go through the cumbersome election process, because that's racist as well. That's We need no excuse absentee balloting. I'd look at things like voting by mail. And so those are just a few of campaign finance reform, too. When you're in redistricting, when our lines are drawn to make our votes count as little as possible, that actually that actually disenfranchises voters. I experienced this as party chair because Culpeper itself is split into five different legislative districts, five in the General Assembly. People don't know where the lines change. People don't know where their lines are, so they get disenfranchised. It makes us less likely to vote and makes our voters disengaged. So I support a host of voting and electoral reforms.
Now, every campaign needs to pay for the basics to get the candidate's message to as many people as possible. And at the same time, corporate money and corporate lobbying are seen as preventing government from taking action on real issues facing the people. You mentioned how your day goes, but how else will you be raising funds to pay for those basics for your campaign? And what do you think should be done about the influence of money in state politics?
We need to get money out of politics. I'm a completely people-powered campaign. No corporate money. We're not going to be like Bryce Reeves, all right? And we're not going to be taking corporate money hand over fist. Completely people-powered. I only take money from, it's a grassroots-powered campaign. So no corporations, no corporate PACs, definitely no Dominion money. I think we need campaign finance reform. I think I just alluded to this. I think we need to ban contributions from public utilities. I shouldn't be taking money from the public utilities that I'll have to turn around and regulate or make contracts with. I think we need to put contribution limits. I mean, you got people taking, we need to put contribution limits. There's no personal campaign contribution limit here in Virginia. So you can take an unlimited amount of money from any donor. I think we should cap that as well. So get money out of our politics.
Yeah, the June 11th primary is coming up quickly. To get elected, you've got to win the support of many voters in the 17th district. Now, you've talked about your door-knocking prowess, or that you appear to like to do it. Mm. So when you're there, how do you describe your candidacy, either at the front door or in an elevator or in passing in a cocktail party?
Mm-hmm. So I always start off with kind of the same conversation. I say, hi, my name is Ben Hickson. I'm running for state senate. And I describe the area. And I say, I would be working for you, so is there anything on your mind, something that you would like me to be working on as your state senator? And that's kind of, that opens up the conversation. And I think it shows what will be my policy as senator, which is listening to the people of this district. That's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to listen. I'm going to work for the people of the district. It's not going to be about me. It's not going to be about special interests. It's going to be about having conversations and having dialogues and working together and treating each other like neighbors and really listening to what the people of my district want. And so that's how I start every conversation. And I think it does reflect my overall approach as senator.
So what's been the hardest part for you so far?
This was especially in 2017 when I first ran, I was so out of my comfort zone. It was it was a huge learning curve. I'd had some public speaking experience as an academic, but that's very different. It's very different. Being a candidate is very different from being an academic. So it was a huge learning curve. There's a lot of things I had to learn. It's been easier this time around because it's my second time doing it, and I've also had this year of this couple of years now of being involved in politics. I'd say that the fundraising is still the hardest part. Dialing for dollars. I mean, you can go for hours with nobody picking up, and that can be gloomy and depressing, right? And finally, so still probably raising for money is the hardest part. But I can say I've definitely gotten better at it my second time around.
What's the best part?
Knocking on doors, talking to voters, definitely my favorite part.
Does sound kind of fun, even when it's not thunderstorming. So what's the best way for people to get in touch with your campaign, to learn more about you, to volunteer, and maybe even donate?
Mm-hmm. So I have a website, benhickson.com, benhixon.com. And then, so I've got, donation links there. I've got more about me there. We've got signups there. So definitely go check out my website. I've got Facebook and Twitter as well.
Now, Ben, if you get elected and get nominated here in the primary, get elected in the fall, and you're about to enter the state senate, what are the top two, three things that you would want to accomplish for the voters of the 17th district?
I think my number one priority is going to be more vocational training, right? Not everybody needs a four-year degree, but, we do need plumbers, and we need carpenters, we need electricians and air conditioning repairmen and welders and bricklayers. These are great jobs, and I have spoken to so many kids who feel pressure to go to four-year college. It's just not for everybody. Not everybody wants to. Not everybody needs to go get a four-year degree. So I have more advocacy for the trades You know, I'd like to build more trade schools again. I'd like to be advocating in vocational training in high schools, more vocational tracks, more apprenticeship programs through unions and through our community colleges. I'm a computer coder. Even that can be taught as a two-year vocational degree. A Virginia computer coding degree. I do have a four-year engineering degree, but I could have learned what I learned in 2 years. So I'd like Virginia to take the lead on this. We have private what are called coding boot camps. And so if we have a public, essentially a public coding boot camp to create a two-year computer coding vocational degree in Virginia, Virginia computer coding degree, that's going to create so many jobs. We've got Amazon coming here now, so we can take advantage of these new tech jobs with this vocational coding degree. So that's definitely going to be very close to the top, if not the top of my priority, more vocational training and more emphasis on the trades. And after that, we've got mental health care, which I think we talked a lot about earlier. Definitely more access to and to mental health care and health care in general, that Medicaid expansion, affordable housing, of course, and transportation and infrastructure as well. So these are just some of the other priorities, some of the things that I hear every day when knocking at the doors, and making sure that we have access to the tools that we need to take care of ourselves.
Now, Ben, we've got problems with our democracy. We've got gerrymandering. We've got voter suppression. What reforms do we need to really make our democracy effective?
Right. Well, I think we absolutely need nonpartisan redistricting. I fully support One Virginia 2021's efforts. In Culpeper, for example, our lines are drawn ridiculously. The town is split into thirds. We're in three state Senate districts and two House districts. The town itself is split right down the middle. When our lines change on a regular basis, that disenfranchises people. We don't, because they don't know who their, if their legislator is changing. They don't know who their legislator is, and that makes it less likely to vote as well. So I definitely support nonpartisan redistricting.
Are there other reforms that we need to make?
Yeah, so I think I did talk about this a little bit earlier, but I think we need things like same-day voter registration. We need to be looking at no-excuse absentee balloting. So we did get this one, so we made it so that you can vote a 1 week early for any reason, but I think it should be 2 months early. I think we should have no-excuse absentee. You should be able to vote in person or absentee for any reason, so no-excuse absentee balloting.
You know, I watch what you... I watch all of the not the town halls, but the candidate debates, especially here in Charlottesville. You know, they got four or five people sitting up there, and they ask you really in-depth questions, and they give you like 90 seconds to answer questions that you could write a dissertation on. What's that like to have to boil down these complex problems into these tiny sound bites?
Yeah, well, you know, it's challenging. I do think that one of my strengths is to take complicated questions and complicated issues and boil them down to simple, practical, easy to implement solutions. I like doing it. It comes from my engineering background. It comes from my problem solving approach to and my listening approach as well. So I do like to take complex problems and boil them down to easy solutions.
Now, a lot of the 17th district is rural area. It's not urban at all. What would you do to help out our rural areas?
You're exactly right. We have a lot of agriculture in this area. So helping small farmers, supporting small farmers is very important to me. I am very excited about making sure that small farmers have the tools to break into the market, about make farming a little less risky. There's actually a great project being built in our district here, the Carver Food Enterprise Center. And so the idea is that it's going to have a canning facility and a pasteurization salon and a commercial kitchen so that if you want to prepare your jams and jellies or your fresh produce to sell in the stores, it's actually very expensive to build one of these fully inspection-ready, up-to-code commercial kitchens on your own. So you go to the community commercial kitchen, you prepare everything there, it's all up to code, you can package it there, and then you can turn around and sell it in the store, right? And so then that's, it's actually better for the environment, because we're not carting food cross country. You know, we're making it easier for restaurants and restaurants and grocery stores to buy local. We're making farming a little less risky. We're supporting the environment, we're creating and supporting the local economy. This is part of the Virginia Green New Deal, which I'm a big fan of. It's kind of like this umbrella term for recognizing that, hey, climate change is happening right now. We need to be aggressive on climate change, but we can be radical and pragmatic at the same time. And we can also realize that, hey, we have economic inequality at the same, and we can fight these two together by, you know, creating jobs, helping the local economy, and fighting climate change at the same time. So helping our small farmers, making small farming a little less risky, and is I think one of my, I'll give you some more examples. When I get on the subject, I get really excited. talking about mobile slaughterhouses, we actually only have 13 USDA approved slaughterhouses in Virginia, right? So that's not, and so it's inhumane to transport your animals long distance. It's expensive when you only have a handful of animals. It's actually out of the realm of just financial means of many small farmers. And so what other states do is they have traveling refrigerated trucks, fully inspected, fully up to code, USDA approved, and so that farmers know when these are coming, they're on a schedule, and so that's a much shorter distance. So just simple pragmatic solutions like that is going to go a long way to help our local farmers.
Well, thanks, Ben. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Thanks so much for spending this hour with our WPVC listeners. This is one of our series of election special interviews with candidates in our area seeking the nomination for city councilor, county supervisor, state senator in the June 11th primary. Each interview will be available on podcast from our website, 947wpvc.org, after it's been broadcast. We thank Ben Hickson for giving us his time so that you, our listeners, can make the best choice of nominees for senator representing the 17th district. Next week, State Senate candidate Amy Laufer will be in the studio for our election special interviews. Thanks for listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
You've been listening to the 94.7 WPVC Election Special Candidates Forum. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Join us again next Saturday at 11 as we talk to yet another candidate for local office in Virginia's 2019 off-year elections. You can hear this program again or suggest questions for upcoming guests at 947WPVC.org or link to it through our Facebook page. Thanks for listening.